Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents Joseph Narcisse's The Templar Chronicles. The Heretic. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by David Coyne, Terrence Aselford, Stephen Carpenter, Mort Shelby, Bradley Smith, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Alyssa Wilmoth, Thomas Keegan, Nanette Savard, Tim Carlin, Ken Jackson, Alexander Strain, Drew Kopis, Eric Messner, Johan Detweiler, and Joe Brack.
Niall O'Connor watched those around him intently. It was early evening, and the Vienna streets were still crowded, which could make spotting a tail difficult. He was a veteran of this kind of operation, however, and so he took his time, carefully examining his surroundings. When he was certain that he hadn't been followed from the museum, he stepped into the phone booth on the corner. Ignoring the mounted public telephone, he removed a satellite phone from his pocket and dialed an overseas number from memory. O'Connor could sense someone's presence at the other end.
It's done.
And?
The Hofburg object is a fake.
And the other?
O'Connor thought back to the long hours he'd spent in the Vatican Basilica. The endless lines, the quiet hope of the faithful, the majestic beauty of the cathedral itself. He'd walked beneath Michelangelo's dome and examined the pilasters, the four square columns that supported it, paying particular attention to the great statues of the saints, Andrew, Helena, Veronica, and Longinus, that rested in niches within them. There was power in the cathedral, great power. He'd sensed its ebb and flow as it reacted to the faith of those inside. In some fashion, almost every object within the building had glowed with traces of it. Even the statue of St. Peter, its right foot worn smooth after generations of caresses by the faithful, had glistened with the faintest of auras, though it wasn't known to be anything more than an ordinary sculpture. The greatest concentration of power had clearly been beneath the dome. Three of the four statues that he'd examined had blazed with it, a result of the true relics each of them contained. Relics that were easily discernible to a man of his particular talents. But the statue of St. Longinus, the one supposedly containing the remnant of the Holy Lance, had not. It was barren, bereft of the same spark of divinity that so encased the other statues and their contents.
That's a fake too.
You're certain?
Yes, I'd stake my reputation on it.
Very well. Return to us, and we will begin the next phase of the operation.
As you wish.
O'Connor closed his satellite phone, put it back in his pocket, and stepped out of the phone booth. Night had come, the Vienna air grown cold and still. He pulled the collar of his greatcoat closer about his neck, glancing around again as he did so. When he was satisfied that he was still alone, he walked to the end of the street, gazing in contempt at the closed iron gates of the Hofburg Palace as he passed. Reaching the intersection, he paused for a moment to light a cigarette, waiting for the traffic signal to change. When it had, he stepped out into the street, confident in the performance of his mission, and already dreaming of the ways in which he would spend his exorbitant fee. The smile of expectation still on his face. He didn't see the city bus surge through the intersection against the light, didn't see the wide front grille bearing down on him, until it was far too late. From where he lay, broken and twisted in the gutter, his dead eyes stared through the windshield of the vehicle at the empty driver's seat. Across the Atlantic, in a darkened room, a gray hand reached out in the half-light and finally replaced the phone, severing the connection. As the SUV turned in through the torn and twisted wrought iron gates that had once guarded the entrance to the estate, Night Sergeant Sean Duncan looked out the window at the destruction around him and knew the rumors were true. The devil had indeed come to Connecticut. The damaged gates were only the first indication. The marble statue of the angel that had stood watch over the entrance to the commandery now rested on its back in the middle of the drive. One wing still stretched wide. The other crumbled into fragments a short distance away. Its stone eyes gazed unflinchingly at the sky above, as if searching for repentance. In the grass just beyond, a group of knights were laying out the bodies of those who had fallen in defense of the gate, the long rows designed to make it easier for the mortuary team as they sought to identify each corpse. Duncan crossed himself. Farther on, past the lawn, the still-smoking remains of a Mercedes sat in the cul-de-sac before the manor house. The once fine leather seats cooked to a crisp and melted across the steel springs beneath. He'd seen his share of combat. It came with a job, but he'd never heard of a Templar commandery being attacked directly. The Holy Order of the Poor Knights of Christ of the Temple of Solomon, or the Knights Templar as they were once commonly known, existed now in secret, away from men's prying eyes. The days when the order guarded the route to the Holy City had long since passed. The general public was no longer even aware of their existence. Finding the base should have been difficult, assaulting and overwhelming its defenses nearly impossible. But someone had done both. According to popular belief, the Templars had been destroyed in the 14th century when the order was accused of witchcraft, and the Pope had burned their Grand Master at the stake for the heresy. In truth, the order had gone underground, hiding its wealth, disguising its power, and managing to remain a viable independent entity right up through the end of the First World War. A treaty with Pius XI was followed by a reversal of their excommunication, and the Templars were reborn as a secret military arm of the Vatican. Their mission? To defend mankind from supernatural threats and enemies. There were thousands of members worldwide, organized into local commanderies. These, in turn, were gathered into continental territories, each led by a preceptor. The preceptors reported to the Seneschal, who in turn answered to the order's Grand Master, the individual who governed the entire order from its Scottish bases at Roslyn Castle. While the order was primarily allowed to run itself, it was still an arm of the Vatican. Over the years, the Holy See had appointed three cardinals to interact with the order's senior leaders to help guide the group along a path that did not conflict with the Pope's wishes. The commandery in Westport, Connecticut, known as Ravensgate, was one of the largest on the East Coast. Only the preceptor's headquarters in Newport, Rhode Island, dwarfed it. The grounds consisted of 38 acres of rolling green hills bounded on all sides by woodland, putting their nearest neighbors more than 2 miles away. The manor house was enormous, 47 rooms, from the firing range in the basement to a chapel in the north wing. And now it was in ruins. The driver pulled to a halt next to the smoldering car, and Duncan stepped cautiously out, his hand on the butt of his weapon. The smell of scorched leather and gasoline washed over him, though the stench of burning flesh he'd expected was mercifully absent. As the rest of his protective detail took a position around the vehicle, Duncan continued to assess the scene. He glanced once more out over the lawn at the work crews, and then he turned his attention to the manor house itself. The damage here was no less extensive. The windows had all been blown out. The odd pieces of glass that remained in their frames reflected the rising sun with little flashes of brilliance here and there, but not a single pane remained intact. The front door was smashed, its splintered pieces still hanging haphazardly in the frame. Bullet holes pockmarked the entryway and surrounding facade. There was a 3-foot-long crack in the marble steps leading up to the door. The sight of it made Duncan's blood run cold. The amount of force it must have taken. Despite the destruction, there didn't appear to be any immediate threat, so Duncan passed the signal to the driver in the car behind him. A moment later, the rear door opened, and Joshua Michaels, preceptor for the North Atlantic region, stepped out. Duncan was the head of the preceptor security detail and ultimately responsible for the man's safety in much the same fashion that the Secret Service watched over and protected the President of the United States. He'd held the post for the last 3 years, the first for Michael's predecessor and the last two for Michaels himself. It was a highly respected position and one that gave Duncan significant insight into whatever current matters the order was involved in. Right now, that meant finding out who or what had attacked them so viciously. The Preceptor had chosen to be on site for the investigation, and they'd quickly made the trip from Rhode Island. A temporary command center had been set up inside the manor house, and it was from there that Michaels intended to oversee the activity. Duncan took his position at the Preceptor's side, the rest of the team forming up around them. As one, they mounted the steps and entered the manor house. Inside, they were immediately met by a group of officers who led them to a room down the hall. As they walked, one of the local commanders brought the Preceptor up to speed. A video conferencing unit had been assembled in the corner of the command center, and upon arrival, Michaels headed directly to it. A technician activated the link, and a moment later, Cardinal Giovanni's face filled the screen.
What can you tell me, Joshua?
Not much yet, I'm afraid, Your Eminence. As you know, the commandery was attacked at some point during the night. Our best guess puts the event in the neighborhood of 3 o'clock a.m., though we'll be able to narrow that down some once the mortuary team has had the chance to do its work. The intruders breached the gates, then struck directly at the manor house. We've been unable to determine if they were after anything else aside from the destruction of the commandery, but it's still early yet. We should know more as the investigation continues. The site's been secured, and the bodies are being tended to. At this point, we've yet to find a single survivor. It's starting to look like we're not going to, either. Whoever they were thorough.
What else have you learned?
Based on what I've seen and learned so far, I'm gonna hand the investigation over to Knight Commander Williams and his team.
The heretic? Are you certain that's wise?
I am. He's absolutely ruthless. He can't be bribed, he can't be tempted, and he won't stop until he's discovered who or what is behind this attack. His men are all combat veterans with the experience and firepower necessary to deal with anything they might uncover, human or otherwise. If the situation is as bad as I'm beginning to believe, I can't think of anyone else I'd rather have leading the investigation.
Listening in, Duncan wasn't so sure he agreed. While Williams was technically a member of the Order, having gone through the investment ceremony just like every other initiate who petitioned the membership, he and his Echo Team unit operated more like freelance operatives than true Knights of the Order. Where members of other units were selected and rotated regularly by the regional leaders, Cade handpicked all of his men, and they stayed with the unit until death or injury forced them out. Where other units answered up the chain of command to the Preceptors, Echo Team reported directly to the Knight Marshal, only two steps removed from the Grand Master himself. They had a reputation for bending the rule, the laws by which the Order operated, and of occasionally following their own agenda. Rumors swirled around Commander Williams like the tide. He'd been accused of everything from practicing witchcraft to speaking with the dead. He was both feared and revered, depending upon to whom you were talking. His nickname, the Heretic, was a result of that fear and the belief among some that he was nothing but a wolf in sheep's clothing, destined to corrupt the Order from within. Duncan tended to agree with them, but this wasn't his call to make. The Cardinal's expression clearly showed the dissatisfaction he had with the idea, but like a good general, he let his people on the ground make the decisions.
Very well. Keep me informed of your progress.
I will. Good night, and God bless, Your Eminence.
Good night, and God bless.
The television screen went dark. Once the connection had been cut, Duncan didn't hesitate.
And with all due respect, sir, I think you are better putting one of the other teams on this. Williams, he might be more trouble than he's worth.
I know he can be difficult to work with, Duncan, but it's his very independence that can benefit us here. Whoever did this knew not only the location of the commandery, but also how to take it by surprise. Without, I remind you, a single word of warning escaping to the rest of us. That takes more than overwhelming force. It takes detailed knowledge of who and what they would be facing.
You believe they had inside knowledge? You're bringing the heretic because of his lack of political connections, then?
Correct. Though that's not my primary reason for using him. I'm convinced that Echo Team is the right choice for the job. They're veterans. They know what they're doing. We're gonna need the many years of knowledge and skill that they'll be bringing to the table.
Based on what he'd seen outside, Duncan couldn't argue with that.
Last I'd heard, the team was on a 2-week leave. Track down Commander Williams and get him here ASAP.
Yes, sir.
As Duncan moved to carry out his orders, he wondered just how bad things were going to get. Williams was at that moment in an alley in one of Connecticut's rougher neighborhoods, watching the front of a two-story dwelling just up the street from his position. The smell of garbage from the dumpster he was using for cover was heavy in the early evening air, though Cade had gotten used to the stench.
TOC to all units. You have compromised authority and permission to move to green. I say again, green.
The bone mic was pressed securely against his lower jaw, the high-tech device carrying his words clearly to the rest of his team.
Five.
He pictured the assault group sitting in their specially modified expeditions half a block away, the breaching rams in their laps. He knew they were concentrating on the sequence to come. Who gets out first? Who hits the door first? How to say drop your gun in Spanish?
Four.
His thoughts jumped to the sniper teams on the adjacent rooftops, his eyes and ears since this assault began. He knew their preparations intimately, from the way they slid that first bullet into the breach with their fingertips, needing the reassurance of feeling it seat properly, to the thousands and thousands of rounds they'd fired, learning the way the weapons reacted to heat and wind and weather.
Three.
He knew that his sharpshooters were aligning their bodies with the recoil path of their weapons, pressing their hips against the ground and spreading their knees shoulder-width apart for stability. He knew what it was like to stare through a inertial 10-power scope at the target, watching, waiting for the moment. He'd been there himself, too many times to count.
Two.
Discipline was the name of the game, and in Cade's unit, it was the only game being played. The stakes were too high, the consequences too horrible for it to be anything but deadly serious.
One.
His men took out the two guards standing near the front door from 250 yards away. The impact of their .308 caliber rounds knocked the targets backward into the tall grass on either side of the front stoop. As the bodies hit the ground, the expedition slammed to a halt out front, the rest of Echo Team swarming the house. The front and back doors fell victim to the breaching rams, flashbangs quickly following. Then Cade's men were inside.
Echo 1 to TOC. Structure is clear. Objective is secured.
Coming in.
Williams would have preferred his usual position on one of the entry teams. He was the type of commander who led by example, not from the sidelines. And staying behind his tactical operations command had been a test of his patience. But his concern over their target's ability to detect his presence had won out over his need to be involved in the action. The need for stealth was over now. Signaling Riley, his second-in-command, Cade emerged from cover and strode briskly forward. He swept up the steps and entered the house, ignoring the sniper's victims lying in the uncut grass on either side of the porch. As he moved swiftly through the lower floor, he passed four other bodies, all young Hispanic males, each lying in a rapidly expanding pool of blood. He had no sympathy for their wasted lives. They were on the wrong side of this conflict, and the unflinching hand of righteousness had finally caught up with them. If anything, he was simply pleased that there were four fewer gangbangers on the city streets. It was the man that his team held captive in the kitchen that truly mattered to Cade. Everything and everyone else beyond that was just a means to an end. Juan Alvarez was seated in the middle of the room in an old chair, his arms pulled back between the steel posts supporting the seat back, and his hands secured together with a set of nylon flex cuffs. Wilson and Ortega stood a few feet to either side of the prisoner, their HK MP5s at the ready and aimed in his direction. His pistol still in hand, but pointed at the floor, Cade crossed the room to stand in front of the prisoner. Alvarez looked as if he'd just been roused from sleep. His normally slicked back hair was in disarray, and all he was wearing was a pair of hastily donned jeans. His usual air of smug superiority was still in place, however. Cade fully intended to change that. Alvarez had been under surveillance by Echo Team for the last 3 weeks. During that time, it quickly became clear that the Bridgeport police were correct in their suspicions. Alvarez was indeed the primary conduit for the movement of heroin through Connecticut and into the rest of New England. Cade didn't care about the drugs. He wanted Alvarez for a far more personal reason, and he wasted no time getting to the point.
Where is he?
Eres madre, es una puta. Y una puta, y espero que arde en el infierno.
Cade understood enough Spanish to know that it was more a commentary on his mother's background than an answer to his question. Shaking his head in resignation, Cade nodded to Riley. The larger man stepped forward and gripped the back of the prisoner's chair, holding it tightly. Cade moved closer and placed the barrel of his pistol against the prisoner's left kneecap. Riley held the chair firmly in place against the man's struggles.
I don't have time for this. I asked you a question, I want an answer. Where is the adversary?
Drop dead, asshole! I don't know who you're talking about.
Expressionless, Cage shot him in the other leg. Riley's arms tensed, but that was the only outward sign of the increased effort he exerted to hold the prisoner securely in place.
Tell me where he is!
Carajo, stupid Opendejo!
Oh boy,
his blood flowed down his legs and began to pool on the cracked linoleum beneath his feet. Cade motioned Riley out of the way. The sergeant lost no time in following orders. Cade raised the gun and pointed it at the prisoner's face.
Last chance, hombre.
With that, Alvarez went abruptly still. His eyes lost focus as if listening to a voice no one else could hear, and his face went slack. Out of the corner of his eye, Cade caught Riley looking at him quizzically, but he kept his eyes on the prisoner, watching him closely, and didn't respond. Without a change in expression, Alvarez began to shake. His head twisted from side to side erratically as it shuddered atop his neck, darting this way and that like a hyperactive hummingbird. His mouth opened wide, stretching impossibly far. It seemed as if he was screaming, but no sound issued forth. Finally, his lower jaw dislocated itself. Cade calmly watched, his gun unwavering from the target. Alvarez's eyes bulged from their sockets, and blood ran freely from his ears. Still, Cade stood and waited. It was only when a widening crack appeared in the center of the prisoner's forehead, a crack that dripped a substance far darker than blood, that Cade reacted. With a twitch of his trigger finger, he put a bullet through Alvarez's skull. The prisoner and his chair went over backward to lie still on the blood-stained tiles. In the silence that followed, no one moved for several long moments as they waited to be certain the thing that had once been Juan Alvarez was good and truly dead. Then Cade gave the signal, and the team went instantly into motion. One of the men policed the brass from the floor, while another checked to be certain no one had left anything behind that might betray their presence in the house. Less than 5 minutes after entry, the team was on its way, leaving behind 7 bodies to lie cooling in the darkness. He stands alone in the center of the street, in a town that has no name. He has been here before, more than once. But each time the resolution is different, as if the events about to transpire are ordained by the random chance found in the motion of a giant spinning wheel, a cosmic wheel of fortune, and not by the actions he is about to take, or has taken before. He knows from previous experience that, just a few blocks beyond this one, the town suddenly ends, becoming a great plain of nothingness, the landscape an artist's canvas that stands untouched, unwanted. This town has become the center of his universe. Around him, the blackened buildings sag in crumbling heaps, testimony to his previous visits. He wonders what the town will look like a few weeks from now, when the confrontation about to take place has been enacted and reenacted and reenacted again, until even these ragged shells stand no more. Will the road, like the buildings, be twisted and torn? He does not know. He turns his attention back to the present, for even after all this time, he might learn something new that could lead him to his opponent's true identity. The sky is growing dark, though night is still hours away. Dark gray storm clouds faced with green and silver lightning are rolling in from the horizon, like horses running hard to reach the town's limits before the fated confrontation begins. The air is heavy with impending rain and the electrical tension of the coming storm. In the slowly fading afternoon light, the shadows around him stretch and move. He learned early on that they can have a life of their own. He avoids them now. The sound catches his attention, and he knows he has exhausted his time here. He turns to face the length of the street before him, just in time to see his foe emerge from the crumbled ruins at its end. Just as he has emerged each and every time they've encountered one another in this place. It is as if his enemy is always there, silently waiting with infinite patience for him to make his appearance. Pain shoots across his face and through his hands, Phantoms of the true sensation that had once coursed through his flesh from their first meeting in another time and place. Knowing it will not last, he waits the few seconds for the pain to fade. Idly, he wonders, not for the first time, if the pain is caused by his foe or by his own recollection of the suffering he once endured at the enemy's hands. He smiles grimly as the pain fades. A chill wind suddenly rises, stirring the hairs on the back of his neck, and in that wind, he is certain he can hear the soft, sibilant whispers of 1,000 lost souls, each and every one crying out to him to provide solace and sanctuary. The voices act as a physical force, pushing him forward from behind, and before he knows it, he is striding urgently down the street. His hands clench into fists as he is enveloped with a desire to tear his foe limb from limb with his bare hands. So great is his anger that it makes him forget the other weapons at his disposal in this strange half-state of reality. The adversary, as he has come to call him in the years since their first life-altering encounter, simply stands in the middle of the street, waiting. The adversary's features are hidden in the darkness of the hooded cloak that he wears over his form in this place. Just as he draws closer, the scene shifts, wavers, the way a mirage will shimmy in the heat rising from the pavement. For a second, it regains its form, and in that moment, Cade has the opportunity to glimpse the surprise in the other's face. Then, everything dissolves around him in a dizzying spiral of shifting patterns and unidentified shapes. When the scene solidifies once more, he finds himself standing in a cemetery. Large, carefully sculpted angels adorn the nearest of the gravestones, with only the word Godspeed carved beneath them. Older, more decayed stones decorate the other burial plots nearby, but he is not close enough to see the details etched there. A sense of urgency grips him in its bony fist. It forces him into motion, and he sets off across the lawn, winding in and out between the stones, letting that feeling guide his passage until he sees a small plot set off from the rest by a white picket fence. In the strange twilight, the rails of the fence gleam with the wetness of freshly revealed bone. The coppery tang of blood floats on the night air. As he moves closer, he can see that the earth on the other side of the fence has been freshly disturbed. A grave lies open, a gaping hole in the peaceful sea of green grass that surrounds it, filled with a darkness deeper than that of the night sky above. This intrusion of the landscape and of the sanctity of the place draws him closer still, pulling him in toward it, the way a fly is coaxed into a spider's web. He stops just short of the small fence and gazes down into the darkness of the grave. Unable to see clearly, he places one hand on the fence and leans forward, straining to get a better look. Something moves down there, a furtive motion. Beneath his hand, the fence begins to twist and turn, tumbling him forward toward the darkness of that open grave, just as two eyes gleam hungrily from that inky murk. Cade awoke in the darkness of his bedroom, his heart pounding and his body slick with cold sweat. He lay still for a moment, gathering his breath, and reached out for the phone.
I'm on my way.
He hung up before the startled novice placing the call could explain the reason for the late night summons. He doesn't need that information. The dream has already told him everything he needs to know. The preceptor was in his makeshift office.
Come.
The door opened to admit the heretic. From his position behind and to the right of the preceptor, Duncan could see Cade Williams was not a large man, but he was an imposing sight nonetheless. His face was all hard lines and angles, without even a hint of softness. This effect was heightened by the wide band of angry scar tissue that stretched from beneath the eye patch covering his right eye, down across his cheekbone and around behind his ear. He entered the room with a graceful economy of motion, but with what also seemed to be an air of caution, as if he were gingerly moving through the world around him. Duncan's gaze came to rest on Cade's hands. The flesh-colored gloves were professionally made, and a casual glance would not have betrayed their presence. But Duncan had spent the last several years paying attention to even the tiniest of details in order to keep the preceptor safe, and he did not miss them. The sight forced Duncan to wonder anew at this man's abilities. 7 years ago, Williams had been a highly decorated officer of the Massachusetts State Police, serving on the prestigious Special Tactics and Operations Team, first as a sniper and later as team commander. He'd been married to his beautiful wife only 5 months before disaster struck. A hostage situation had forced him into a confrontation with a supernatural entity that Kate had taken to calling the Adversary. His wife had died as a result, and Kate himself had been severely mauled. He'd lost the sight in his right eye, and the flesh on that side of his face had been so savagely disfigured that plastic surgery hadn't even been considered. He had gone into seclusion for several months after the incident, avoiding the press and doing his best to come to grips with what had happened. Somehow, he discovered the Order's existence and successfully petitioned to become a member, claiming that his unique talents could be put to use on its behalf. Duncan knew it hadn't taken long for Williams to rise through the ranks to his current position as Knight Commander. It was rumored that Kate had joined the Order with ulterior motives in mind, that he believed the information he gained was the best means of locating and confronting the Adversary, that the Order's goals and objectives were secondary to his own. It was said that he was after one thing, and one thing only: revenge. In preparing for the meeting, Duncan had read the unit's after-action reports, the written summaries turned in after any engagement requiring the use of lethal force. Every one of them showed that Echo Team had been exemplary in the performance of its duties. This, of course, reflected well on the team's leader. Yet Duncan could read between the lines, could see what the other commanders thought of Williams. While Kate flawlessly performed as was expected, those who had used his services were always uneasy doing so. They were happiest when he had completed his mission and was on his way. It was there in the written recommendations, in the seemingly casual comments made when discussing him or his unit. They were afraid of him. At its heart, the Order was still an arm of the Church. As such, it believed in the divine province of man and in the salvation garnered through the grace of the Lord. How a man rumored to be able to walk with the dead and able to read a man's mind simply through touch fit into this picture was difficult to determine. Duncan did not blame the others for their fear. If everything that was said about him was true, Cade Williams was a man who should be feared. Yet watching Cade wait patiently for the preceptor to acknowledge him, his one good steel-colored eye taking things in with frank appraisal and seeming not the least bit uncomfortable in the preceptor's presence, Duncan knew one thing for certain. Cade Williams had the best chance of succeeding at the job ahead. Michaels finished with his reading, signed the form, and handed it off to his assistant. He rose and extended his hand in greeting.
Thank you for coming, Knight Commander.
Sir.
This close, Duncan could see that the patch over Cade's eye hid the majority of the damage to his face, but the scar tissue that peaked around it gave testimony to the ruin beneath. His wide shoulders and strong physique clearly showed his dedication to remaining at the peak of performance. He was dressed in a black sweater, jeans, and a pair of work boots. His hair, thin and dark, hung to just above his shoulders, loose and unfettered.
Please, sit down.
I'm fine, sir.
Suit yourself.
The preceptor turned to his new aide, a short, dark-haired man by the name of Erickson, who was filing the just-signed report.
That will be all.
Duncan remained where he was.
As you've no doubt heard, this commandery was attacked last night by persons unknown. While we don't know precisely what happened, we do know that every single member of the Order that was on the grounds at the time was slaughtered. Clearly our people resisted. The evidence of a massive firefight is overwhelming. But that's all we know. They put up resistance, then died, down to the last man. Which is where you come in, Commander. I'm assigning Echo Team to find out what happened here. Who attacked us? Why? And more importantly, how did they manage to wipe out an entire complement of our people?
With all due respect, sir, we're a combat unit. Wouldn't it be better to put one of the investigative squads on this? They've got the training and the connections to...
I've considered that, but I've decided I want a combat team on this right from the start. Eventually, those conducting the investigation are going to run into whoever is behind this attack, and will need combat experience to deal with the situation. With your particular expertise, I think you've got the best chance of determining just what is going on, and coming up with a plan to put a stop to it.
Cade stared into the preceptor's eyes for a long moment without saying anything. He glanced up at Duncan momentarily, returned his attention to Michaels, then reluctantly nodded his agreement.
You'll also need to replace the missing man in your unit.
My team is fine as it is, sir.
Duncan tensed, his hand involuntarily moving to the hilt of his sword. He knew there had been a problem with the last knight assigned to Williams's team, but the file had lacked any details.
We've been attacked, Williams. I want every unit at full strength, particularly yours. You can either pick another team member, or I'll assign one myself. It's that simple, and I'll allow no argument on the issue.
Duncan fully expected an outburst from Williams, and he stood ready to impose himself between the two men.
Fine. I'll take him.
Duncan didn't know who was more surprised, himself or the Preceptor.
He's the head of my security detail, Commander. Surely there is someone more suitable. Someone not currently under such heavy assignment.
Again, with all due respect, sir, I'd prefer not to add another team member this soon. If you're forcing me to do so, then it is my right to select the man I want, as the rule itself outlines. I'll take the sergeant. If he's good enough to guard you, he should be good enough to be on my team.
Trapped by his own logic, the Preceptor had no choice but to agree, much to Duncan's dismay. Kate left the Preceptor's office with his new teammate in tow, only to find the other two members of his command team waiting in the hallway outside. It seemed they'd been summoned by the same industrious initiate as he had. With an assignment of this magnitude ahead of them, he was reminded again how lucky he was to have men of such abilities under his command. The two men couldn't have been more opposite from each other. Master Sergeant Matthew Riley was tall, black, and generally imposing, with wide, muscular shoulders and a clean-shaven head. His usual grim expression seemed to have taken on an additional weight after learning what had happened here the previous evening. Sergeant Nick Olson, on the other hand, was slim, short, and white, with curling reddish-brown hair and the type of smile that had you constantly looking over your shoulder, waiting for the practical joke. Riley was demo and weapons, Olson, computers and electronics. They'd been with Cade for several years. If he was the mind of Echo Team, they were its heart and soul. Their courage and dedication had been tested under fire time and time again. He trusted them implicitly. He quickly filled them in on the details of their new assignment and introduced them to Sergeant Duncan. As he did so, Kate thought about his impulsive decision to use his sight while in the Preceptor's office, and of the resulting flash of power it had shown centered around the new man's hands. It would be interesting to see how the other men in the unit reacted to Duncan's unique gift when they learned about it. But they'd deal with that later. For the moment, it was time to get to work.
All right, here's how we're gonna tackle this. Riley, I want you focused on the identity of the attackers. I want to know who they are and how they got inside. Olson, you're in charge of security. I want this place searched top to bottom. I don't care if the locals have done so already. We're gonna do it again our way. Check the electronic surveillance records from last night. Duncan and I will meet the medical team and see what we can learn from the bodies.
Cade looked at each of them in turn, waited for their nods of agreement.
The Preceptor's given us carte blanche on this one. So if you need equipment or personnel, don't hesitate to requisition them from the locals. Any questions?
All three shook their heads.
All right then, let's do it!
A makeshift mortuary had been set up in one of the gymnasiums, the base infirmary being far too small to handle the number of casualties they were facing. The bodies were laid out in long rows stretching the length of the room, while teams of physicians were moving among them with portable computers, trying to match faces, dental records, and fingerprints against the commandery's personnel records. It was obviously going to be a long and tedious process. Cade picked a row at random and gave a couple of the bodies a quick visual inspection. While he was no doctor, he'd seen his share of combat wounds. Bullets and explosives had their own unique signatures and were relatively easy to identify. But to Cade's dismay, nothing here looked familiar, which meant they were up against more than the ordinary. Once the medical team had finished with a body, a recovery team moved in. It was their job to collect any of the Order's communal property that might still be useful, the arms, armor, and equipment that were routinely issued to each soldier. Personal effects were collected for later distribution to the other men who were close to the deceased, for the majority of the Order's members were without family, aside from their brethren. As Cade watched the team gently lift the body he had just examined so they could remove its bulletproof vest, he was struck anew at the sacrifice these men made for the sake of their fellow human beings. Forced to live in secrecy, without family, without friends, yet dedicating their lives to protecting the innocent from things no sane man would choose to face. It was a remarkably lonely life in many respects. A life he was too well suited for, it seemed.
Can I help you?
A dark-haired man in a white lab coat stood nearby, a questioning look on his face, a look that quickly disappeared when Kay turned to face him.
Commander Williams, forgive me, I did not recognize you at first.
My unit's been put in charge of the investigation.
Kay jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the rows of the dead.
What can you tell me about him?
I've only just started my examination of the bodies. I can't possibly...
I know you haven't been at it for very long. All I want is your initial impressions. Start with what killed them.
I'm afraid I can't answer that.
And why not?
So far, I haven't found a single bullet wound. Or anything else you might expect in the aftermath of a confrontation with a group of well-trained and well-armed attackers. The kind that would be needed to overwhelm a location like this, for that matter. No bullets or bullet wounds. No knife cuts. No telltale patterns indicating the use of fragmentation grenades, or any modern explosive at all, in fact.
What?
I've looked at 14 bodies so far. 7 had their guts torn out. 4 were decapitated. 2 seemed to have been killed by a high fall. Their bones pulped almost beyond recognition. The last one drowned.
Drowned?
In the fountain in the courtyard. Something tore him up pretty good afterward, but it was the water that killed him.
So what are you saying, Doc?
If I had to take a guess, I'd say that nothing human killed these men.
But I'll stop before this time.
After speaking with the doctor, Kate had ordered up a pair of trikes, and he and Duncan had set out on an inspection of the estate's perimeter. They'd stopped several times so far. Each time, Kate would dismount in order to examine something more closely. And each time, Duncan had to wonder why. An unadorned section of outer wall, a clump of bushes, a tree with several broken branches. None of them appeared to have any relevance to the mission at hand. And it wasn't long before Duncan grew impatient with the entire process. He kept his mouth shut, though, unwilling to question his new commander's methods. It would have been different were he in charge, but since he wasn't, there wasn't much he could do but grimace and bear it. They'd covered roughly 2/3 of the perimeter so far, and had just emerged from a dense stand of trees into a small clearing near the edge of the estate. This time, Duncan left his engine idling and refrained from dismounting. He watched as Kate carefully examined a rough, muddy patch of ground not far from where he parked his trike. A small trickling stream ran nearby, and the commander moved over to that next, bending to look at it more closely. The stream was running from the mouth of a metal culvert some 10 feet away, a culvert that ran underground beneath the commandery's outer wall, placed there to help facilitate runoff during the spring months as the thick winter snow melted and flowed downhill. Duncan knew from inspecting the plans prior to the Perceptor's arrival that while the pipe was large enough to admit someone, it narrowed in the middle and was bisected by a mesh barrier that stopped anything larger than a rat from crossing from one end to the other. There was no way the attacking force had penetrated the grounds at that point, and Duncan couldn't imagine what it was the commander found so intriguing. He watched in amazement as Cade went down on one knee, dipped 2 fingers into the brackish stream, then brought those fingers to his lips. The gesture was so out of place that Duncan finally turned off the engine of his trike, dismounted, and walked to the commander's side.
What is it?
Not sure yet.
Cade moved forward, carefully watching the flow of water as it emerged from the culvert. He must have seen something, for he suddenly stepped forward and stuck his head into the pipe's opening. A second passed. 2.
A light. Quickly!
Duncan jumped to obey. He hustled back to the trikes, pulled a high-powered floodlight from the saddlebags on his own machine, and swiftly returned to Cade's side.
There's something inside. Something moving.
Cade took the device, switched it on, and shined it into the depths of the culvert. Something was jammed about 20 feet inside the pipe, something that was too big to make it through the narrowing opening that led to the other side. Something that wore the red insignia of a Knight of the Order. They wasted no time in going in after him, whoever he was. Duncan was smaller, so he was chosen to make the extraction while Cade radioed for help. He lowered himself into a crouch and crawled inside the culvert, flashlight in hand. Duncan tuned him out, concentrating on the task before him. The inside of the pipe smelled strongly of rotting algae, and beneath it, he could taste the thick scent of blood. He noted that the water beneath his feet was tinged with a slight shade of red. Seeing it, he understood what it was that had caught Cade's attention. He had to give the man credit. He knew he would never have noticed so insignificant a detail from the back of a moving ATV. He kept the flashlight trained down the length of the pipe ahead of him, and as he got closer, he began to make out more details. The man was crammed into the pipe as far as he could go, his body squeezed into the narrower section ahead of him, as if he'd been trying to fit inside and gotten stuck. His face and upper body were hidden from view, but Duncan could see the man's hips and lower legs. The gray jumpsuit he wore was liberally stained with blood. One foot was bare, the boot inexplicably missing.
Med team's on his way. How we doing?
Almost there.
The tunnel narrowed again, and Duncan was forced to get down on hands and knees, the cold metal above pushing against his back. The water flowed over his hands and around his legs, chilling him further.
Just a few feet more.
His right hand touched the man's boot. He was there.
Hey, can you hear me? Are you all right?
Duncan swept his light over the other man, trying to assess his condition, but the narrowing scope of the tunnel prevented him from seeing anything. He was simply going to have to haul the man out and hope for the best.
I'm gonna try and pull him out.
Duncan shut off the flashlight and put it down behind him. It wasn't going to do him any good going backward, and he needed both hands for the job ahead. Reaching out, he grabbed the man by both ankles and started shuffling backward, pulling as he went. Once they were free of the culvert, they carried him over to a soft patch of thick grass and set the man down gently. Kay checked for a pulse, then immediately turned his attention to the man's wounds.
He's alive, but just barely. Another 10 minutes.
Duncan doubted the young initiate even had that much time left to him. A savage wound ran along the right side of the man's rib cage. The gleam of bone and the softer pink of internal organs could clearly be seen. It looked to Duncan as if something large and remarkably vicious had come along and taken a bite out of the man. Other, smaller wounds were visible on his chest and face. Round holes bored into his flesh. He had already lost a tremendous amount of blood, and a thin stream of it continued to flow out of him as every second passed.
Where the hell is that emergency team?
Cade was trying to stem the flow of blood from the man's wounds. It wasn't working. Duncan was about to suggest putting the man on the back of his ATV and rushing for the manor house.
We're out of time. You're gonna have to heal him.
Heal him?
We don't have time to play games, Duncan. I know you can do it. You can't hide that from me. Now quickly, before it's too late.
Duncan, however, had no intention of healing the man, fellow knight or not. He didn't know how Kate had discovered the secret he'd kept hidden from the rest of the order, but he wasn't about to end 11 years of abstinence just because the man told him to do so. Some things were more important than others.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Suddenly, a four-wheel drive pickup raced into the clearing and stopped just feet away. The medics were suddenly kneeling beside their fallen comrade, working to keep the man alive. They did their best, but in the end, it wasn't enough. The man's wounds were too grievous. His body had lost too much blood. They worked over him for another 5 minutes after he'd gone, doing what they could to revive him, but eventually they gave up. As the medical team loaded up the body and prepared to depart, Commander Williams stepped over to Duncan's side. Cade gripped his shoulder, his fingers digging painfully into the muscles beneath.
The enemy didn't kill that man. You did. His death is on your hands.
They regrouped later that evening in the Commandery's Great Hall. Cade, Riley, Olson, and Duncan. The rest of Echo Team was officially on stand-down, waiting for the senior members to determine an appropriate course of action, but they'd been placed on unofficial standby status by the senior NCOs. It was still too early in the investigation to need them, but that didn't mean it would stay that way. Duncan was the last to arrive. Cade didn't even turn to look at him as he crossed the room and took a seat at the end of the table near Sergeant Riley. The meeting immediately got underway. Cade turned to his number two.
Riley.
The team's security and demolitions expert had been assigned the task of examining any evidence left behind by the attackers. He unrolled a large blueprint of the facility and its surrounding grounds on the tabletop for the other men to see.
I started with the gate.
Riley pointed to the entrance into the compound, the same one they had all driven through several hours earlier.
You've all seen it. Clearly it's how the attackers gained access to the grounds. Considering its condition, my first thought was that they had used explosives, but I was unable to find any blast marks or explosive residue on the gate, the columns, or the road itself. Nor did I find any damage to the gatehouse. My next thought was that they had taken a relatively large vehicle and simply driven through the gate, but the lack of paint residue or clear impact point ruled that out as well.
Riley shook his head.
Something came through that gate. Something big. That's about all I can tell you right now. I left a forensic team at the gate just in case I missed something and moved on to the rest of the grounds. There were several areas that showed signs of a confrontation. Here, here, and here.
He pointed on the map to large grassy areas in front of the main entrances to the manor house.
Prior experience says that the local knights made a stand before the entrances, giving their brethren inside time to prepare themselves for the assault. I collected blood samples and shell casings from all three locations. The blood was sent to the lab for analysis, though I suspect it won't tell us much other than it came from our brethren. I examined the bullet casings myself. All of them were standard issue 9mm ammunition. That leaves us with three options. The attacking force didn't fire a single shot, used the same caliber weapons as our troops, or policed their brass so well that they didn't leave behind even one shell.
Remembering the doctor's comments from earlier that afternoon, Cade suspected the former.
Tire tracks? Shoe prints?
Neither. Wasn't for that damn gate, at this point I'd be willing to believe that they flew in over the wall and flew out again the same way, without ever touching the ground. According to the physical evidence, our guys were the only ones here.
Cade turned to Olson.
What about you?
I'm afraid what I have isn't much better. Using some of the preceptors, men, I organized search parties to cover the entire estate, particularly the manor house. We searched this place top to bottom. We looked in every room, every closet, every nook and cranny. Except for the wounded man you and Duncan discovered, we didn't find a single survivor. It's really too bad the medics weren't able to save him. We might have learned something from him. Right now, all we got is a lot of bodies and no answers.
Duncan waited for Williams to denounce him in front of the other squad members, but the commander simply nodded at Olson to continue.
While the teams were searching the grounds, I spent some time checking the electronical infrastructure. The alarms and emergency warning systems are all functional, so are the cameras. Yet last night, every single one of them failed for approximately 3.5 hours for no known reason. The backup systems also went down. Whoever they were, they came through our security like it wasn't even there. They knew exactly what defenses we had in place. Even worse, they knew just how to get around them.
Duncan didn't like what that implied. It added more credence to the preceptor's belief that it had been an inside job, something Duncan would have considered inconceivable before then. For the first time, Cade looked in his direction.
Where did we get with the interviews?
After he'd escorted the med team back to the manor house, Duncan had been ordered to interview the men who'd first discovered the situation.
I confirmed that the men had been isolated from each other since our arrival, and then interviewed them one at a time. Aside from a couple of insignificant details, they tell the same basic story.
Duncan knew that the other team members would be measuring his response, trying to get a sense for how he would fit into the group. He spoke calmly, carefully weighing his words, directing his response to Cade, but knowing the other two sergeants were listening as well. First impressions were important.
Both men had been on leave together, rock climbing in New Hampshire for the weekend. They received an urgent page from the duty commander at around 3 a.m. this morning, signaling them to return as soon as possible. Well, they packed their gear and drove south immediately thereafter, arriving here at around 7 a.m. They were obviously too late. Now, I checked their service records. They both seemed to be good men, dedicated to the order and its mission. They are clearly distraught over what has happened, and so far haven't given me any reason to distrust their explanation or question their story.
Finished with his report, Duncan sat back and waited.
All right. Unless forensics comes up with an angle we haven't seen yet, we're gonna have to do this the old-fashioned way. I want all three of you working the files first thing in the morning. Start with the latest threat assessments. I want to know every single individual or organization in the last 6 months that has been labeled by our intelligence people as dangerous. Of those who have actually made threats against us, I want to know who has the manpower, financing, and equipment to pull off an assault like this one. After that, we need a list of any other group or groups that are capable of such an attack, regardless of whether they've showed up on a recent watch list or not. They caught us once unprepared. That will have boosted their confidence. Chances are they'll hit us again. The longer we take to get a lock on who they are, the higher the likelihood of its happening again.
Cade turned to face Riley.
I'm going to recommend to the preceptor that he place all of the North American commanderies on alert effective immediately. I want you to work with the temporary base commander to come up with a suitable way of protecting this location in case they decide to take another shot at us this evening. When you're done with that, put the rest of Echo on 12-hour standby. I have the feeling we're gonna need them sooner rather than later.
Temple Commandery, Cincinnati, Ohio. Knight Lieutenant Nathan Jessup stared nervously out into the fog, unusually thick and heavy fog. Instead of clinging to the ground in small swirling pools and eddies, it rose like a wall, sweeping down the length of the row that was the only entrance to the estate, a juggernaut inexorably marching forward. From where he stood on the opposite side of the tall iron gate that governed access to the property from the road, Jessup watched the fog advance slowly through the night, until it stopped a few hundred feet from the gate. He was shivering, not as a result of the cold September night air. He turned away from the sight and stepped back inside his guard shack. He crossed to the small portable heater and stood in front of it, trying to warm the chill from his bones. Every few moments, however, his gaze was drawn back to the windows and the slowly advancing fog that crept its way toward him and his meager sanctuary. Ordinarily, he didn't mind such weather. It made driving some of the backcountry roads a bit difficult and played havoc with his ability to keep his window clear, but that was usually the worst of it. This fog was different, though. Its very presence tugged at his nerves, and more than once, Jessup felt like someone was watching him when his back was turned. Watching, waiting, moving closer. He shook off the uncomfortable feeling and decided he'd stood there alone in the dark long enough. It was time to hear another human voice, and remember he wasn't the only one out on the grounds pulling guard duty that night. He put the handheld radio close to his mouth, intending to check in with control.
What the?
Lowering his hand before keying the mic, he stepped outside his guard shack to investigate. A minute passed with Jessup standing just inside the gate, his head cocked to the side in an effort to hear better. 2 minutes. Three. He was about to give up and blame it on his overactive imagination when he heard it again. As Jessup listened, the footsteps grew closer. Gradually, a figure could be seen, moving out of the haze toward the gates. It was indistinct at first, nothing more than a darker stain against the lighter fog where the spotlights cut into its heart. But before long, as it grew closer, Jessup could tell it was a man. Whoever he was dressed against the night's chill in a long overcoat with a hood pulled up and over his head, obscuring his face from view. The visitor strode up to the gate and stopped. Jessup watched the man examine the gate, him, and the area beyond. But the man's hood shrouded his face in darkness, and the guard was unable to see his features.
Can I help you?
The visitor made no response. Jessup stepped a few feet closer, the radio in his right hand forgotten, his left hand on the butt of the pistol at his waist.
Sir, this is private property. Can I help you with something?
It took Jessup a moment to realize what the sound was. The man was sniffing the air, like a dog tracking a scent. His head moved in a slow circle, the sniffing continuing, until at last it came to rest, pointed about 15 degrees off center. Turning his head to follow, Jessup realized that the manor house lay directly through the trees in that direction, despite the fact that it couldn't be seen from the street. Jessup felt his skin crawl at the sight, and a chill passed through him.
He'd had enough. This was just too weird.
Turning back to his mysterious visitor, he opened his mouth to order him away from the property. But when he turned around, he found that the fog had suddenly jumped forward, closing those last few hundred feet until it stood like a barrier on the heels of his hooded visitor. It writhed and rolled, churning about like it had a life of its own. Faces could be seen here and there within its depths, gray, distorted shapes with mouths open wide in silent screams, ghostly phantoms shrieking for release. Jessup stumbled backward, the radio falling from his right hand in shock as his left hand clawed frantically for his weapon. It was too late. The intruder raised an arm and pointed a hand at the gate. A hand that was battleship gray in color, with an extended finger tipped with a long, curving yellow nail. The sound pounded at Jessup's ears, forcing all thoughts out of his head except the need to cover his ears and escape from the noise.
He forgot both the radio and the gun, slipping to his knees and using his hands to try and block out the sound. Despite this, he found he couldn't take his eyes off the figure standing on the other side of the gate. The fog grew more agitated as the keening continued, the faces forming and dissolving at furious speed, each more horrible than the last. Then, something larger moved within the depths of the fog. Jessup watched in horror as the fog suddenly charged the gate. He glimpsed an indistinct shape of horrendous proportions in its depths. Then the bars of the gate were peeled apart to create an opening large enough for a man. The strange visitor stepped through the gate, and the fog followed obediently at his heels.